You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. My name is Lenny Noizette. I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Fund here at OSI. I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening. We're pleased to see such a great crowd for what I'm sure will be a lively conversation. Talking Texas Tough. Texas Tough is a powerful book by Soros Justice Fellow Robert Perkins, a book that chronicles the growth of prisons in Texas and in the South, and that will set the stage for a broader discussion between Robert and advocates working on the ground both in Texas and nationally. In case you haven't had a chance to read the book yet, let me tell you what has been said about it. Charles Ogletree from Harvard Law School has said that Texas Tough is a raw, compelling assessment of racial disparity in Southern culture as they have determined the massive over-incarceration of African Americans. If you want to understand how politics, not crime control, governs today's prison population, read this book. Anyone concerned with justice and fairness should place this on their must-read list. Ben Jealous, the president of the NAACP, says, Texas Tough shows that the politics of race has always governed the politics of punishment and explains why our criminal justice system is the front line of America's human rights struggle in the 21st century. So we're particularly pleased to host this event tonight because Texas has long been a focus of OSI's criminal justice reform efforts. And we currently support groups working on sentencing reform, challenging the death penalty, seeking to improve public defender offices, and challenging immigrant detention practices, among other things. Robert is one of a long line of Soros Justice Fellows working in the state as well. Some of our former fellows are in the office and in the audience tonight. I want to recognize them. So if you're a former fellow, could you stand up? And coincidentally, today we announced our 2010 fellows, and two of them are here with us, Jesse Wegman and Renee Feltz. Where are you guys? Stand up. Please join me in welcoming them to the OSI family. And please check out our website for information on their exciting projects and those of their colleagues. But Texas is special to us here at OSI for another reason. It's the home of our own Ann Beeson, Executive Director of U.S. Programs, who will be our moderator tonight. For those of you who don't know about Ann, Ann joined OSI in June 2007 as the Executive Director of U.S. Programs. Prior to joining OSI, Ann was the Associate Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, where she spearheaded groundbreaking initiatives to stop the erosion of civil liberties in the name of national security and to expand the use of international human rights strategies in the areas of immigrants' rights, women's rights, and racial justice. Ann has argued twice before the U.S. Supreme Court, and in 2007, she was named one of the 50 most influential women lawyers in America by the National Law Journal. As I say, she's a Texas native, and she holds a master's degree in cultural anthropology from the University of Texas. So before I invite Ann to kick us off, I want to recognize the people who are responsible for pulling the event together tonight. Adam Colbraith, the program officer for the Soros Justice Fellow Program. Christina Voigt, who's a program associate with the Fellowship Program. And Karen Fish from our communications department. They put a lot of time and energy in here, and so they are the ones that make this happen. So now I introduce you to Ann Beeson.
Thank you, Lenny, and thank you all for being here. As Lenny said, he's already revealed my secret, which is, yes, I am a Texas native. After reading this book, and even before reading this book, I'm a little hesitant to claim that heritage. But it's true. I just want to say, Robert... when was that? Maybe several months ago, I guess, when it was still in bound galleys and all that. Asked if I would read the book and consider writing a blurb for it, which is always a bit of a iffy proposition because you know you're ever going to say no kind of once you agree to read the book. But in this case, this is actually one of those books that and my husband can attest to this. He's not here because he's at home with our son. I would literally be reading it late at night, and I couldn't help but like read passages aloud because it was just so disturbing to me. I thought I knew everything there was to know about just how bad the Texas criminal justice system was. And in fact, Robert taught me through this book that there was a lot of stuff that was even worse than I could have imagined. So it's not a cheery read, but I strongly encourage all of you to buy the book and to read it, because it tells us a lot, not just about Texas, but about the challenges and the deep history and legacy in this country of a criminal justice system that targets people of color and that continues to lock them up at numbers that are outrageous when compared to anything that the rest of the world does. So I'm very, very excited about the opportunity to moderate this conversation. And I can't claim to be an unbiased facilitator, so I'm not going to even try. I have my own opinion about these issues and will probably inject it from time to time. But I do want to welcome our terrific panelists, in addition to Robert, who is, of course, the author of the book and also a professor of American Studies, right, at the University of Hawaii. We have one of my favorite Texas criminal justice advocates, Ana Yanez Correa, who is the executive director of the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition and also a former fellow, right?
No.
Why did I think you were a fellow? See, we claim people even in them when they aren't fellows. Yes. Anyway, Ana's been doing amazing frontline work to reform the very systems that have evolved over the course of many years in Texas, and believe it or not, with real success. So Ana is actually here to cheer us up. I'm glad to say. And then finally, we have Nicole Porter, who coordinates the Sentencing Project state work on and legislative work and communications work on criminal justice reform. And Nicole's going to be able to help us build connections between what's happening in Texas and what's happening elsewhere in the country on criminal justice reform. So welcome to all of you. We're going to try to make this very interactive and dynamic. So I'm going to just throw out questions and encourage our panelists to jump in. I guess just before I do throw out the first question, I will just say one more thing about my own connection to the state and deep belief in the need to expand support for criminal justice reform around the country. And that is, I remember very vividly the lessons that I was taught in the Texas history classes in fourth grade. I actually had a Texas history teacher whose name was Mr. Crockett, believe it or not. He was an African-American Mr. Crockett, which is even more unusual, and not related, I don't think, to the infamous Davy. I can assure you that none of the history lessons that are in this book were taught to me as a student in elementary school in Dallas, Texas. And in fact, and I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, and that's why I so encourage you all to read the book, there are even kind of core facts about the origin of the Texas independence movement that I literally did not know. And for example, I did not know that one of the primary reasons that Stephen F. Austin so fought for independence from Mexico was because Mexico had actually abolished slavery, and all of the white colonists in Texas didn't want to have to abide by this new rule that Mexico was imposing on them, because of course they were all trying to get rich from cotton, and to do that through slave labor. So there were just a number of really frightening facts that we didn't learn in Texas, we don't learn in our American history classes, that that we all need to continue to build public awareness around. So with that, Robert, I'm going to throw to you the first question. Why did you decide to write about Texas, and what relevance does the Texas experience have to the broader epidemic in this country of mass incarceration?
Thanks so much, Anne, for the nice introduction, and everyone for organizing and coming out on this lovely evening for a difficult topic, but I hope we have time to exchange ideas toward the end as well. I started this project quite a long time ago. In some ways, it germinated when I was in college for the first time when states across the country were starting to spend more on corrections than they were on higher education. And in graduate school, I started reading the literature and found that even though the prison boom has really been, by the numbers, concentrated in the South, mm-hmm. most of the prison growth has been in the South. And even more, if you count the Sun Belt, most of the highest rates of incarceration are in the South. Really, the journalism and the scholarship was really focused mostly on the North and, to a lesser extent, California. So I first thought I would go to where my mom's family is in Mississippi then I thought I might work on, I did some research in Louisiana, but it kind of, the more I learned, it became clear that Texas really is where the action is in American criminal justice. It's at the kind of epicenter of the historic shift in U.S. criminal justice policy and, I would argue, social welfare policy over the past 40 years in the United States. It has certainly the largest penal system in the United States now. It's surpassed, again, California, even though California has a third larger population. So there's 171,000, roughly, people in prison in Texas, about 750,000 of them under criminal justice supervision. And that's not a static population. There's people coming in and going out, about 75,000 a year. So there's a lot more people that are involved in it. It is, you know, it leads the nation in the aggregate numbers of people held in for-profit facilities. There are 20,000 of them. It leads the nation in those held in supermax isolation cells that wall off people from virtually all human contact. I listened to an NPR interview the other day with Roxana Saberi, who's just come out with a book about her experiences in prison in Iran, and she talked about how incredibly trying it was, kind of soul-destructive, to be held in solitary confinement for 2 weeks. And I've corresponded with prisoners who have been in solitary for months, for years, in fact, some for decades, in very similar sorts of conditions. This is just kind of starting to change in the last few years, but, you know, Texas prisoners are still expected to work full-time, and they're paid nothing for their labor, not even the sort of token wages that convicts earn in other states. They report the highest rates of sexual assault in the nation. It obviously, of course, famously has the most active death chamber in the nation. Another kind of point of Texas singularity is that it has such prosecutorial courts that tend to wield rubber stamps more than gavels, and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is sort of so notorious in this regard that they have been regularly rebuked by the federal judiciary, which is, as we know, is hardly a bastion these days of bleeding hearts. You know, in recent years, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has refused to release an inmate who was twice proved innocent by DNA testing, has refused to order a new trial when it was revealed that the prosecutor and the judge had been sleeping together, have approved until the historic Supreme Court decisions, approved the execution of juveniles and the mentally retarded. And just about a week ago, the court intervened and granted a stay to Hank Skinner, who came within a hair of being executed in Texas, despite the fact that the prosecutor for years had been refusing to test the physical evidence from his crime scene. So on the one hand, it's the kind of biggest, baddest prison system in the country. It also there's a kind of long history that I think has shaped that present. And that's kind of how I come at it differently than some of the other people who look at the criminal justice policies of the present, as I try to kind of trace it back and look at the ways that our own moment has come into being and the way that there are echoes of the past that continue to sound in the present. And in Texas, really, if you trace the law enforcement traditions back to the Texas Rangers, one of the first law enforcement bodies formalized in the United States, that was really a body by the records that was more devoted to ethnic cleansing against Native people and Mexicans than it was anything we would think of as kind of public safety enhancement. And likewise, the disciplinary traditions of the prison you have to trace back in Texas, not to the reformatory impulse, however flawed, that developed in states like New York, where it was people who kind of enlightenment intellectuals who and church leaders and Quakers who thought they would create these institutions to encourage prisoners to have penitent solitude. And that never quite worked out. But in Texas, it's really traced back to slavery and convict leasing, the system of totally privatized punishment that developed with quite horrific results after the Civil War. And then I'll just say one more thing. And really, but Texas is more than that. It's not just the embodiment of a kind of deep Southern model of the prison, but it's also kind of refined that more than states like Mississippi or Louisiana. And in that way, Texas has really had a lot more national influence.
So I was just going to ask you, Robert, to draw out a little bit more the connection you make so strongly in the book about the legacy of slavery and the actual prison system in Texas and elsewhere in the South. So tell us a little bit more about that. Yeah.
Well, in most Texas, like other Southern states, built penitentiaries quite like Northern penitentiaries in the 19th century in the antebellum era, but they were typically reserved exclusively for whites and to a lesser extent Mexicans. But slaves could be punished by the law. They were mostly punished by their masters, but only by noose or by whip. As one expert on Southern law put it, the slave can only be reached through his body. And after the Civil War, there was this kind of crisis, this kind of turning point in Southern states and in Texas, because suddenly this whole huge demographic portion of the population came under the full jurisdiction of the state rather than the private discretion of their owners. And especially as Reconstruction began to fall apart and white supremacists fought their way back to power through what can honestly only be called the most sustained and successful campaign of terrorism in American history, they had their own war on crime that ended up producing record crops of mostly black felons, many of them convicted of petty property crimes. And as these felons began to accumulate, Southern states from Virginia to Texas didn't build more prisons. Instead, they started hiring out their prisoners to the highest bidder, to railroads and mining companies. For the South's first Fortune 500 company, TCI, was started as a convict concern, and sugar and cotton planters. And these people were worked to exhaustion and frequently to death, made huge amounts of money for the state. Sometimes the majority of state revenue in many years came from the rent paid for the labor of prisoners, made tremendous fortunes for some of the most kind of powerful and wealthy individuals and companies in the South. In that way, the New South was built in partially built by convicts, in the same way the Old South was built by slaves, in ways that we haven't, as kind of society, haven't reckoned with, really, and with horrific results for human rights. And there's kind of a lot of stories about that in the book. But this tradition really continues. I mean, a lot of reform, there were lots of scandals and lots of reform movements, and convict leasing finally fell apart in the progressive and the populist eras, but instead of kind of launching onto a reformatory style of what came to be called corrections, Texas and other Southern states mostly just took over the properties that had been managed by lessees and continued those practices as before. And that carried on clear into the 1980s, went through a lot of changes, especially with federal court intervention in the 1980s. But even when I showed up and began doing my research in the 1990s, stepping into a Texas prison was, in a way, like going to Colonial Williamsburg in a gritty sort of way. It was like a kind of living history theme park. There were the Ho squads going out to work, almost exclusively comprised of blacks and Latinos. Mm-hmm. And worked in a gang labor fashion. That style of labor, command labor, had fell apart everywhere in the United States after emancipation was preserved exclusively in prisons, and it persists now, watched over by armed white men on horseback, driving them to the fields. Many of these plantations have been commercially active since the 1820s, and they've never brought in a crop with free labor, and the racial disparities of it were also, I remember visiting a tier reserved for juveniles sentenced as adults on one of these farms in the South. So it was all like 15, 16, 17-year-olds, and walking down and just cell after cell after cell after cell making eye contact with kids, high school and middle school kids, tweens and teens, who many of whom face a lifetime of captivity, or years and years. They remain up and well into adulthood in captivity. I asked them I was there in August, so, and it happened to be harvest season, so what they were doing in the daytime was picking cotton and attending classes if they hadn't missed those privileges, if they hadn't been revoked in the evening. So, just as their parents might have done or their grandparents might have done as sharecroppers, just as their great-great-great-grandparents might have done as slaves. So there are ways that you can more directly see the ghosts of slavery animate in the present. And with the prison boom, I think we've seen this template, this Southern template of corrections has really expanded its reach in a metastatic way and has influenced and reshaped corrections nationwide as rehabilitation has fallen apart and as we've moved to a kind of permanent subjection of people who have criminal records to a kind of second-class citizenship status.
So Anna, kind of flash forward to the present. You're working on criminal justice issues in Texas. What does the landscape look like now? I know that you had a role in passing a number of reforms beginning in 2003. Tell us a little bit about that and what the ongoing challenges are to this legacy that Robert has laid out so clearly.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for this wonderful event and everybody for being here. And I know that I'm supposed to cheer you up, but man, it's hard. It's hard to cheer you up when you see, and please really read this book. I haven't finished reading the whole book, but what I've read so far has really made me appreciate how far we have come as advocates in the state of Texas. Because you cannot undo years and years and years of entrenched racism and just dehumanization of a whole population from 2003 till now. So thank you for helping us appreciate how far we've gotten, because man, it's pretty intense. So please read the book. Basically, in Texas, the issue has always been how many prisons are we going to build? And usually it's like, how many prisons am I going to build in my backyard? It's never been the dialogue of building prisons versus not building prisons is not the dialogue that happens in Texas. And in January 2003, there were projections that Texas would need additional beds, up to 13,000 new additional beds in terms of their population. And during 2003, there was also a budget shortfall, budgetary crisis, that resulted what's the first thing that they cut in the state whenever there's a budget shortfall? It's anything that helps people. So that's what happened in 2003. But because of the budget shortfall, there were policies that were passed that we're seeing the positive results of it right now. One of the policies, for example, was putting people who suffer from substance abuse, instead of putting them in jail, you would have probation as well as community supervision as well as treatment. So that was one of the good policies that came out of that. And then there were other policies that basically limited the number of people entering into the system. But the cuts were horrific. Even as many policies as we were able to pass as advocates, utilizing the arguments of, save taxpayers' dollars, save taxpayers' dollars, the cuts were horrific. And in 2005, Texas was again faced with this idea that, oh my gosh, we're gonna have to build a lot more prisons. So the numbers that they gave in 2005, the projections, what they were saying is that in this year of 2010, we would have the need for more beds of 14,490. So that would be a lot of new prisons. Okay. Well, now, I mean, we have not built a single prison because of the reforms. So in 2005, they said we were going to need a lot more prisons to have, you know, to be able to accommodate the 14,490 additional people. But because of the reforms that took place, not a single prison has been built. Now, what were some of the reforms? There were three basic reforms. One of them was, because Texas was on a crossroad to build or not to build prisons, they invested a substantial amount of money on diversions. And this was really a game of numbers. What do I mean by a game of numbers? You had agencies saying, we're going to need an additional space. We're going to need 14,000 new additional beds. And those are like the number games, the projections, right? And we had advocates basically saying, what you can do is, instead of building these prisons that you cannot, that you don't have enough guards for, because there's a huge guard shortage in Texas, and instead of building these prisons that you cannot fund, let's go ahead and use that money, about $249 million, which is a substantial, it's a substantial amount of money. Historically, that amount of money has never been given to anything dealing with treatment and diversion and so forth. But it's very small compared to the huge budget that it takes to incarcerate. It's like $3 billion that just for the mere incarceration of people. So it's not like we were asking for like $1 billion, although I wish we would have had like $1 billion. But just the small amount of investment reduced the number of people in terms of numbers. Okay, so community supervision, which is probation, was in heavily, you know, there was a lot of investment on. And then there was a major policy that we were able to get that shortened the years that people could be in probation. So the years that people had to be in probation were 10. We lowered it to 5 years. That's still a long time. But, I mean, for Texas, you know, from 10 to 5, it actually made a significant change. So what we had to do in 2007 is reduce the number of people going into the reducing the number of people so that the projections could say we don't need prisons. And that's where we are right now. In 2007, not only did we manage to keep that diversion money intact, but we managed to add additional funding for things like reentry coordinators. As Robert pointed out, I mean, when everything is said and done, you have people that do not have the right to make a livelihood for themselves. It's like another, they can't get a job, they can't get housing. It's just like the barriers are tremendous. And so last session was the session for reentry. So there were a huge number of bills, housing vouchers, so that people can get housing because, you know, if they had a record. Mandating for the second time, third time, the driver's license, so that people can get driver's license when they come out of prison. Hello. I mean, I know it's supposed to, these are like common sense stuff that people are like, yeah, why don't you give them driver's license? But to us, it was like, oh my gosh, you're going to get driver's license. And then the creation of a reentry plan so that everybody who goes in prison has an actual reintegration plan so that they can start working on what are they going to do when they come out. So the list goes on and on in terms of reentry. So we focused on what we had to do was stop the prison construction. So like we focused on that. That was stopped. The second one was continuing the investment. That happened. And then the third one is, what are people going to do when they get out, which is like 72,000 a year in terms of living, you know, their livelihood and so forth. So those are some of the things that we've been able to do.
Great. Thank you, Anna. So, Nicole, you've been working in a number of other states. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how these reforms compare to reforms in some of the other states you've been working.
Sure. Well, thank you for inviting me to participate. And let me first start off by saying that I'm from Texas. I grew up in Northeast Houston. And the reason why I got involved in criminal justice is because the neighborhood I grew up in, Greens Point, which is a little bit north of Houston, there was a point of time in my late teens, early 20s, when all of the guys that I had grown up with were cycling in and out of the local criminal justice system. Some of them actually went on to the state system, but most of them were just getting locked up on a regular basis in jails around the city. So, and actually I have a twin brother. His name is Nicholas, and he's in the ninth year of his felony probation term in Texas. And so I've learned a lot from watching him and learning from his experiences while he's been on probation. And so that's sort of what inspired me to get involved in these issues and to find an opportunity to work with the Sentencing Project. So, and I was actually in Texas in 2007 when the reforms passed and was able to participate in some of the efforts that were going on in the state then, and know that Texas is definitely at the forefront of this narrative that has been developed, that's in the midst of still evolving around addressing criminal justice and changing the way crime is responded to in this country. At the time of the 2007 reforms, several states were passing similar reforms, and again, there was this narrative that was evolving in this country. That was sort of the fruits of labor of organizations like Critical Resistance, for organizations like the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition at the national and at the state level that was contributing to changing the way people were thinking about these issues. In 2007 specifically, 25 states introduced progressive policy reforms ranging from modifying mandatory sentencing to looking at parole policies such as what happened in Texas, and looking at juvenile justice issues. States like Colorado and Mississippi actually adopted moderate incremental reforms that allowed prisoners to get out early and has really contributed to changing the way parole is looked at in those states. And of course, in New York, the Rockefeller drug laws had a significant impact a couple of years ago, and the state achieved a really great success last year when additional reforms were passed to change the Rockefeller drug laws. And in fact, last year, 19 states passed additional progressive reforms. In addition to New York, Rhode Island repealed mandatory minimums for certain drug offenses. Again, really sort of contributing to the way states are responding to crime and changing the approach that lawmakers and folks in the communities are responding to crime. I just wanted to give a little bit of statistics regarding what's been going on in the last couple of years, because this narrative, I think, has been really significant. In 2008, we were able to document that 20 states actually decreased their prison population. And in 2009, the Pew Center for the States just released their prison count report last month, and they documented that in 2009, 26 states were able to reduce their prison population. Texas was one of them.
For the first time since 1969.
Right. Texas was one of them, actually able to reduce their prison population by about a little over 1,200. But other states... And that decreased the prison population by about 1%. But other states also achieved really substantial declines in their prison counts. Rhode Island saw a decline of 9.2%. Michigan saw a decline of 6.7% in 2009, and that followed a 3% decline in 2008. New Hampshire saw a decrease of 6%, and Maryland saw a decrease of 5.6%. So states are addressing these issues. A lot of times that's not what gets covered in the newspaper. A lot of the headlines that sell papers are, I wish I had printed out some of these headlines, but you know, there's been a lot of horrible reporting in the New York Times recently around early release programs that are going on in Michigan and California. The reality is that states are taking action to sort of address their growing prison populations and try to control them and actually reduce them. So there have been significant successes over the last couple of years.
Great, thanks. And just wanted to mention too, I get lots of fabulous reports from the Sentencing Project, mm-hmm. and I actually just read recently this great report you all came out with that really kind of studies in detail four states, I think it is, Nicole, that managed to reduce their prison populations recently and the lessons to be learned to replicate in other states.
Yes, yeah. So we just put out Downscaling Prisons, mm-hmm. Which you can find on our website, mm-hmm. and document the reforms that took place in Michigan, New York, New Jersey, and Kansas, and talks about how those states actually adopted reforms to reduce their prison populations.
Yeah. Obviously, there's so many arguments that fabulous advocates like the folks up here are developing. One of them in this economic climate, of course, is the cost savings, as Anna mentioned. And I was you saw me leaping through the book a second ago. I was trying to remember this phenomenal figure that Robert has, like in the introduction, about the amount of money that our country actually spends on the prison system every year. And I mean, just kind of guess. I mean, not all you experts in the audience, but just a guess from a lay person as to how much money we spend every year in the U.S. on the prison system. Just like random guess. Anybody? Come on, be brave. Somebody throw out a number.
And throw out a low one so she looks good.
Yeah, exactly. Come on, throw out a number. $212 billion.
That's for the whole criminal justice.
Yeah.
That's for police too, but yeah. $70 billion just on incarceration.
Okay. Thank you, yeah. Robert. See, he's the one with the real numbers. But anyway, $212 billion on the entire criminal justice system. $212 billion. It's phenomenal. Anyway, just had to kind of fit that in. So, Robert, you in the book look at a number of previous reform movements in Texas and elsewhere, some that were somewhat successful and some that were not. What lessons do we have to learn from those? And I find generally, and this is not just true in criminal justice, but in other fields that we support, that we have a very short memory. We don't actually tend to learn as much as we could from past efforts. And so, you know, what would you say would be some of the successes and failures of the prior movements that we might learn from today?
I mean, movements have gone both ways in Texas history. The whole history of the state, you can kind of think of it as a history where freedom sometimes goes forward and freedom sometimes goes backwards. And both of those are propelled by popular and political movements, grassroots or elite driven. I mean, the retreat from Reconstruction was a white supremacist movement that turned out to be quite successful and established Jim Crow that endured for a century. And looking at that history, I think makes clearer the ways that mass incarceration is also a kind of second great retreat from freedom in American history. You know, and if you look back at the things segregationists were saying in the 50s, Strom Thurmond and others were warning, there's going to be a crime wave if we have integration of the races. And when they lost, because there was this freedom movement across the country, on the streets, in the courts, in the Congress, when those reactionaries lost on desegregation, they retreated to criminal justice as a way to impose order upon this incipient society they feared and had fought against. And in the same jurisdictions that fought desegregation most vociferously have become the nation's most avid jailers. But so there's the history of kind of right-wing movements in the book, and then there are also really quite inspiring movements at every stage to try and bring kind of sense and evidence to the table, and also to kind of have empathy with prisoners and to treat people in a humanitarian way across the system. And there were, a whole group of people, labor unions and radical farmers and church women and kind of intellectual modernizers kind of came together and finally helped wipe out convict leasing, which endured for, 40 years and was making huge amounts of money for people, but they were able to do it. One of my favorite, one of the stories I found kind of most captivating or surprising was that this group of suffragists and temperance activists, this group of very powerful women in the state of Texas in the 1920s that had won the right to vote, they had won prohibition of alcohol, and they decided that their next big project was to take over the prison system. And they started this huge statewide campaign, and they actually took over the prison system of Texas for a brief moment in the late 1920s and tried to sell off the prison plantations and build this therapeutic, what they called penal colony, near Austin. It didn't turn out so well, as I'll explain in a minute. But it still was inspiring to see that what they were able, the institutions that seemed permanent, that they were able to dislodge, that had endured just as long as mass incarceration has now in the United States, if not longer, and seemed just as unmovable. And of course, prisoners also, for that brief moment when the judicial branch in the United States was the most progressive branch of government and listen to the weak instead of just the strong, that moment has passed. And, you know, the judicial branch was the most reactionary branch of government for most of American history. But from the Warren Court and to a lesser extent in the Burger Courts, that changed. And at that moment, prisoners jumped in, and for the first time, they gained a voice in courts, and they helped bring federal consent decrees in prisons across the country and took over and remade in significant ways prison systems in Texas and across the South. All of these movements were successful, and in some ways they were also in some cases defeated or gave rise, you know, the history of prisons is a history of unforeseen consequences, many of them grim. You know, Texas abolished leasing, but it carried forward the gang labor and brutal and labor exploitation and racially divisive practices of convict leasing. So it continued under another name. The women who were able to take over the prison system in the 20s were sabotaged by the high-level officers who were their employees. They weren't given any financial support from the legislature right at the moment when they were trying to set up schooling and programs. They had bad luck with hurricanes for their budgets, and also the prisoners, when discipline got a little more lax, and also intentionally guards were turning a blind eye in order to try to undermine them politically, prisoners escaped in droves. 30% of the prison population escaped in the second year the women were in control, partially because of the collusion of these officers with their escapes. And so anyway, pretty soon a hardline group came and took over. And you know, likewise, those heroic, very inspiring prisoner rights suits in the 60s, 70s, and 80s didn't create the kind of merciful community corrections system that they imagined Judge Justice and others imagined that they were creating. They created a more professional bureaucracy, but in the middle of the rightward turn in American politics, it became a much more gigantic and in some ways harsher bureaucracy. You know, beatings went by the wayside, but supermax incarceration came up in its place. I mean, in terms of lessons, there are a whole lot of them, but trying to distill the big ones across all of these different movements is hard, but I would say...
The women in charge, that's the first one, right?
Yes, but make sure they get in charge of the guards, too.
Yeah.
They have to be in charge at all levels, not just the top. So, I mean, the first lesson is that any system, no matter how entrenched, can be changed. That's the most important one. I think the movements were most successful that looked at the whole criminal justice system. As a lot of organizations are doing in the United States now, you know, then you need to look at it all together, policing, courts, the actual institutions, and release, because if you fix one part of the puzzle, you can have another part of the apparatus come back and bite you. I think it was one way the women in the progressive era went wrong is that they weren't actually paying attention to prisoners' lives. Prisoners in many free world movements are kind of props. We kind of project onto prisoners either the right, or we sometimes project onto prisoners our fears or our fantasies of their violence and menace, or we also sometimes project onto them our nurturing fantasies of being able to turn them into some sort of different person with the proper mix of love and education. And it's better to kind of talk with prisoners and involve prisoners and former prisoners in those movements so that they have voice in them. OSI has been particularly good at that. And then the last thing I would say, at least for the present, is that I think because so many prison reforms can win and create monsters on the other side that they didn't anticipate, it's really important for us, I think, to at this point, at this juncture in history, to keep our eye on prison reduction. And all, no matter what we're kind of, what piece of the puzzle we're working on, whether it's indigent defense or reentry, we have to constantly be thinking about ways to shrink this system that is just so corrosive and pays so little dividends in terms of public safety, devours so many of our resources, mm-hmm. has so much collateral damage, especially among the most vulnerable of our society. And so it has to be downsized radically. That has to be our goal, and then it will take a lot of cooperation for us to get there.
Can I just interject quickly?
Please do, yeah.
So I think one of the big reform reform movements that happened in Texas was the Ruiz lawsuit as a part of the condition suits that you mentioned. And I actually worked at the Texas ACLU, and when that lawsuit was settled, the lawyers donated money to the ACLU to continue sort of the idea of prison monitoring and jail monitoring going. So I was able to join them and continue to do that conditions work, conditions advocacy, and got a chance to work with a lot of the prisoners and jail detainees on those issues. One consequence, I think, of Ruiz is that in addition to sort of the state prison system, the beds that are counted inside of TDCJ, that they count every year and put out into the public domain every year, that there was sort of this parallel prison system that was created under Ruiz that is not under supervision of TDCJ, but is under supervision of the state probation department. And I mentioned earlier that my brother is in the ninth year of his felony probation term. Well, during his sentence, his community alternative sentence, he cycled in and out of sort of this parallel prison system that's under the management of the state probation department. So I mentioned that to say that if you look at the Bureau of Justice statistics numbers that they put out every year, they always claim that Texas's prison system is about 171,000. About 171,000 people are incarcerated in Texas prisons, whereas TDCJ's numbers every year are at 152,000. And it's because there are these phantom beds that are not under control of TDCJ, but are really under supervision of this of the probation department. And so when my brother was locked up in one of these facilities, he got sick and actually tried to call and figure out like what was going on with him and see what I could do to help him out. And nobody knew where he was. I was getting letters from him and I had his address, but nobody knew exactly where he was. There was no one who I could reach who could tell me what was going on with him and who could at least give me a status on his situation. And so I just wanted to raise that in the context of.
So is it kind of an example too, Nicole, of like kind of an unintended consequence of what looked like a successful reform effort in terms of creating this parallel system?
Yeah. And that still, we really don't know like what the system is in Texas, right? Because you have these one, you know, BJS is reporting one number every year, and then TDCJ reports this other number. And the people on probation, it's a significant amount of people who are on probation who cycle in and out of this sort of parallel system.
Right, wow.
Another example of that, just real quickly, is that Ann Richards, during her governorship, she, as an alcoholic, was really focused on kind of drug treatment. She really pushed TDCJ to really launch, and they did launch, the most aggressive, most largest in-site treatment initiative in the country. I mean, it was absolutely massive. There weren't even enough drug counselors for them to hire to kind of staff this massive initiative. But that was part of here's an example of like not paying attention to the overall scale of the system. There was a compromise with conservatives in the state that they would increase incarceration and prison boom building in exchange for creating these treatment beds. And then when W came to power, all of those treatment beds were just converted to regular prisons. So it was a kind of corrupt compromise, one quite similar to that's being set up with immigration, which is, you know, enhanced enforcement, enhanced detention in exchange for amnesty, and there are types of compromises maybe that are not worth making.
Yeah, I want to actually come back to the immigration detention question, but first let's talk a little bit more about the strategy question,
okay.
Right? And so, Anna, you know, Robert makes a very strong case in the book about, you know, the fact that racial politics are responsible for the rise of mass imprisonment. Based on your experience in Texas, though, how do you think that criminal justice reformers should use evidence of racial disparities in, you know, as an argument in, you know, for reform? I mean, how does that fly in terms of a strategy now in Texas and in other places? Yeah,
it doesn't fly. And you have to use it very carefully. And, I mean, I think our friend Vinny in the back will attest, when he was with JPI, he Hi, Vinny. He came to Texas when all of this stuff was happening, and he was really helpful to us. Really appreciate him. Basically, when advocates, I was undocumented and I was, immigrant and things are unjust and you want to lead with race, you want to lead with justice, you want to lead with what is burning inside of your belly. We all have different stories as to why we kind of do this kind of work. And so all of us wanted to, at least the advocates of color, wanted to lead with, the issues of racial disparities and the issue of justice and things that, are so clear, were so clear to us. And one of the things that we had to do was kind of step back based on polling information that we got. There were two specific polls that took place. One of them was a poll that basically looked at how Texans were going to respond to reforms in 2003. And the pollster that was hired at the time was a pollster that Governor Perry used at the time, because we wanted to know what does his peeps think about this kind of stuff. How far can we move, reform, what messages? And one of the most troubling things that was found in the response is that anytime you mentioned race, it swayed the argument against us. Anytime that you mentioned race, it was like, even if the questions were very, if you have a substance abuse problem, would you prefer them to be in treatment versus prison? And then if you threw the word race, forget it, it's like prison, And so that was very troublesome. The following poll after that gave us sort of like the three messages that have been working since then, which is, saving taxpayer dollars, increasing public safety, and strengthening communities. And these are the three specific messages that have been really helpful strategically helpful in terms of moving policymakers into the reforms that we want to do. And the interesting thing about what we see with our policymakers now is that, unlike other states where you see the backlash of some of the reforms, like Nicole was saying, in terms of early, parole release, we have not seen that type of backlash in terms of the media in Texas. In fact, you see a lot of the conservative, representatives claiming, owning, Texanizing the reforms and saying, we're leading the nation and we want to be the model. And that's okay in terms of like short-term results, but then it also has this, for advocates, it's really difficult because that there's this racial disparities, that there's a lot of injustice, that you got to call them. There was a bill that the Sentencing Project helped, in terms of an impact statement. Every single policy should have a criminal justice impact statement. And the thing that killed that bill from happening was that it had the race issue. People did not want to know how it impacted people of color or just the ethnicity of people. And the author of the bill, who was on the House side, who was the first African-American woman, we call her Mama Thompson, she's awesome, Symphonia Thompson, it was like the battle between Symphonia Thompson, first African-American woman, and Representative Debbie Riddle from Katy, Texas, ultra-conservative Republican, who thinks that your public education is, socialism. And so it was like this battle between them, basically saying, why do you want to put the word race in this impact statement? And Representative Symphonia Thompson is like, because it's impacting people of color, and I want to know. And so just as recently as last session, we were not able to get, a bill like that, because there's such a complete denial from policymakers about what is happening in terms of their biases. So,
can I interject?
Yeah, and actually, and Nicole, I was going to absolutely would love to also have you say a little bit about, how this plays out in other states and what you're seeing in terms of trends in other states, what strategies are working in terms of communications and messaging.
Sure. I mean, I would say that the tension between Thompson and Riddle in Texas over why a racial impact statement bill couldn't be passed, saying that Riddle, the white legislature, didn't want it to be about race meant that the entire conversation was about race and about her unwillingness to articulate it, to accept it, and to own it, and her collusion with the, within the racism that permeates in the Texas legislature and that permeates in the Texas prison system. Because let me tell you, I've been into many Texas prisons, and you can't walk into a Texas prison and not know that the overwhelmingly large number of black and brown people who were locked up in those cages, that it's not about race that got them there. So the fact that the Texas legislature can't deal with that, can't even have the conversation, means to me that it's all about race when they can't even bring up the issue on the floor of the House or in a committee room. In 2010, so for me, it's about the fact that it is about race and how to neutralize white opposition in states like Texas and how to address that. And certainly identifying other messages, like Anna mentioned, that sort of bronze the coalition and can speak to bringing other stakeholders into the conversation for criminal justice reform is critical. Racial impact statements have been adopted in other states. They've been adopted in mostly white states, actually, Iowa, Connecticut. And actually, the racial impact statement in Iowa was able to improve for the better sentencing policy that would have horribly impacted communities of color and African Americans in particular. And so I've seen, you know, horrible bills be introduced, and racial impact statements actually work to mediate the proposed policies that are on the table. So I do know that, you know, they're a tool and a mechanism to certainly slow down the process of passing these horrible sentencing enhancements that contribute to lengthening the terms of stay in our prison facilities and, you know, widening the net for people who get locked up. And, you know, they've been effective. And other states that have considered them have been Oregon and Florida. So these policies, we're hopeful at the Sentencing Project that other states will continue to at least talk about race as it pertains to the criminal justice system. Because you can't look at even just statistical charts, look at the overrepresentation of black and brown people who are represented in the criminal justice system, walk into any correctional facility and see all of those faces and not know that it is about race. And for white legislators to go there, you know, the corrections chair in Texas goes to the prisons. They are pretty good about that. But I've also, and, you know, they're not stupid, but I've also, you know, seen them in these committee hearings just really sort of have their sort of white-colored or rose-colored glasses on and refuse to acknowledge the elephant that's in the room. And it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ludicrous. And so it's about neutralizing that opposition and those and that framework when we're talking about the criminal justice system.
I mean, I would say it makes sense for you to, when you're in the legislature, to craft the arguments that you think will win within the session that you're trying to fight. And it's amazing to the extent to which you've been able to accomplish this in very difficult circumstances. I mean, you really very much are the heirs to these other inspiring movements that made big changes in the past. But, you know, one hopes anyway that there are ways to move legislation with it, you know, putting pressure upon those who are currently holding the levers of power. But really, in order to shift and to significantly downsize this system, it's going to take more than that, the kind of budget-driven, low-hanging fruit reforms that we've been able to accomplish thus far. Not that we shouldn't celebrate those and escalate those and continue those, but, you know, I think it, you know, it took a civil war to get rid of slavery. It took a freedom movement to get rid of segregation, and I think it's going to take another freedom movement to get rid of mass incarceration. You know, so there has to be a kind of grassroots strategy as well. What I hoped to kind of do in the book was give, I mean, advocates, I think we're talking about, because it's so obvious, it's the elephant in the room, we're talking about racism as a driving force and as a significant variable in criminal justice. What I hoped to do was kind of give an overwhelming amount of relentless evidence to show that that was the case, so to give them kind of greater confidence to make those claims, at least in the forums where they think they will resonate, or to try to push the forums, you know, and the framing as far as you think you can at any given moment.
I mean, that's why we want your book. I mean,
exactly.
The thing. It's like when we saw this, it's like, we're going to distribute it to every single member that we know that works on corrections so that they can read it. And there are some historian buffs that will not be able to deny the facts about this. And, I mean, we are obviously faced with a lot of challenges, and this is why this question is really important, because when you're on the ground as an advocate and you have to ask yourselves, what is the number one priority? Do you want to minimize the number of people going into prison? Do you want to go ahead and pass these reentry policies? Do you want to do that? And so you do that, and you build a campaign, and you do messaging, and you formulate, you know, the formless army strategy. This person says this, and this person says this, and nobody knows we're actually working together. And you have the right wing group saying what you want them to say, and you have some law enforcement people that you can actually get on your side to say this. Yes, it gets those results, and it's really nice. You see that it's happening. But one thing that we as advocates still are struggling with is, how do we really talk about how do we really talk about race, and actually, while doing so, expect policies to actually happen? If we would have led with race, these things would not have happened.
Right.
I know that. So those are just challenges that are real, that we have to deal with in Texas. And we're still, you know, that's why we were going to kidnap you, and, you know, you're going
to
talk to all the members,
but
and,
I can pretend to be kidnapped.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I would just say that I don't think that this is an either-or thing. I have the privilege of sort of sitting at a seeing kind of social justice field at a bird's eye view, kind of. And this tension exists in many other kind of related social justice movements. And I think that sometimes we make the mistake of thinking that you have to have a one-size-fits-all strategy, and that the communication strategy you use with state legislators, for example, has to be the same one that you use when you're organizing people for the mass movement that we all understand has to be a part of the overall strategy for reform, right? So that would just be one observation that, of course, you're going to lead with race when you're trying to organize and empower and mobilize communities of color to kind of fight back against these structures. But you may not lead with race when you're talking to a state legislator. So just I wanted to get back to immigration, actually, to make the observation too on this very point that as we all know, that this is not the racial disparities do not just impact African American communities in Texas and elsewhere. They impact many other communities of color, and in particular Latinos, most of whom are immigrants. And to observe yet another fact about Texas, where Texas is first, which is that it also leads the nation in detention of immigrants. And what is and this is not just immigrants in Texas. This is all of the New Jersey and New York immigrants who are being shipped by ICE to Texas. To be detained in these very, very, very far away places in South Texas and elsewhere. And just to ask Anna about this connection and to say a little bit about the implications of the overall rise in immigration detention for the broader efforts to kind of stem, this epidemic of mass incarceration.
At the state level, we have been successful at stopping anti-immigration policies. The ACLU has done a really good job. MALDEF, other groups have really done an amazing job at the state level. And there's at least 27 bills every single session against immigrants. One of the bills that we didn't get as much support as we wanted to was the immediate deportation of somebody who was on probation because of their immigration status. Now, we killed it. The bill was able to be killed, but it wasn't because the other advocates jumped in. So, like, your regular pro-immigrant advocates did not jump in on this bill because it was like, wow, but they're they've committed a criminal act, and that's what they were probation, so we're staying out of it. The people who actually came to the rescue in that particular bill were probation directors. Probation directors spoke up against that bill, saying that the people that they supervise who are undocumented are the ones who follow the rules the best, and they pay their fines on time, and they are actually the least amount of trouble. And if they wanted to deport every single person who was on probation because they're undocumented, they were going to suffer a huge financial cut in the probation department. I mean, they were just saying all these things that, it was like they're like the model probationers. So why do you want to do this? And it's the immigration's job. It's not our job to act as immigration. So it was interesting to see that. But in the challenge that we have in terms of Texas is that even though we see that the prisons are not being built because of these numbers game, we're kind of winning on the numbers game. we're seeing that on the federal level, you know, there's like this huge boom of more prisons. And the only thing that we can think of doing in terms of private prisons is having the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, who is the entity that looks at the conditions of jails and so forth, have purview over some of these private prisons, so to have some type of review of their conditions. But every time anything like that happens, the lobby for the private prisons come and completely kills any type of effort that deals with more of that. So it's interesting to see that you have this win on this side, but then all of a sudden you don't have any control in terms of the federal level. And the people who are there at the federal level, like Cornyn and Kay Bailey Hutchinson, they're not necessarily very easily, can't really talk to them about, look, stop this. I mean, because that's like their platform. So
I thought she was a socialist.
Oh, no, that's not.
That's what Rick Perry said.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the socialist, yeah.
Can I add something? Mm-hmm. So I contribute to this blog called Texas Prison Business, which actually tracks private prison beds mm-hmm. in the state. And actually the first private prison that was ever built in the country was actually built in Houston. And it was at the time the INS Processing Center right outside of Houston. In 2006, I was one of the organizers on Hutto, which is, for those of you who don't know, it was a family detention center that actually detained babies from like zero, on up to young children. And at the time when I started detaining kids in this facility with their parents, they didn't have any standards for what the educational programs were. The kids were actually wearing uniforms. And that facility, which is right outside of Austin, was actually a former medium security prison that used to contract with TDCJ. And so the issue with immigrant detention in Texas is really, is obviously a huge problem. And one of the sort of features that sort of contributes to why it's so pervasive is how private prison companies can actually go into Texas and build these facilities on spec. There's 256 counties in Texas. Conceivably, ICE could contract with every one of them to detain undocumented immigrants in those facilities, in facilities that were that could be constructed in each of those counties on spec. And it would take, there are grassroots organizations that are working to stop the construction of those facilities at the front end. Grassroots Leadership, which is an organization I volunteer with, does that work in Texas. But, waging those battles on a regular basis, county by county, with local government agencies who ICE can contract with and who private prisons seek out to build these facilities on spec is, just a huge undertaking. And it's part of sort of the way the system is structured that allows that to even happen.
Yeah, and just to kind of, paint that picture a little further, the point is like you close one, like we succeeded in getting Hutto closed as a kind of family detention center, but then it just pops up somewhere else in some other county hundreds of miles away across the state or something. So it's absolutely a huge challenge. I want to quickly get to your question. So I want to just first, though, ask a kind of, closing question of each of our of each of our panelists, which is what do you each see as the biggest barriers and the biggest opportunities to criminal justice reform around the country? And Nicole, maybe start with you, and then we'll go this direction.
Mm-hmm. I think the fact that you can't have an explicit sort of race-focused conversation in state legislatures around the country and really sort of address the racism that continues to contribute to the criminal justice system and how large it is. Because until elected officials are challenged with how racist criminal justice system policies contribute to the overrepresentation of communities of color in the system, then we may never really confront why the system as a whole needs to change and why the number of people who are under some form of criminal justice supervision, not just in prison, but on probation or parole, why that number needs to be reduced in general, because we just supervise way too many people in this country. What opportunities there may be. Certainly the recession is a window in into sort of addressing these issues head on. But I also think, again, like I was mentioning earlier, that the narrative around challenging criminal justice has evolved over the last 11 years, I would say, starting in the late 90s when critical resistance came onto the scene, and it certainly evolved with a lot more stakeholders participating in the conversation, and I think continuing to broaden out that coalition of organizations and people who are concerned about the number of people we have under criminal justice supervision and who want to challenge it will be an opportunity for us going forward.
Right now, the biggest challenge that we're going to have is that we are we're going to be facing an $11 billion budget shortfall in this next upcoming session. So the biggest challenge we're going to have is basically keeping all of the diversion money that we were able to get that slowed down the prison. So that would be the biggest challenge. But with that challenge, you know, comes this huge opportunity to basically further passing of laws that reduce the number of people going into prison, sort of like what happened in 2003 with several of the bills. There have been dialogues of the possibility of closing down prisons in Texas, at least one. And so that dialogue is happening, and we're going to continue to push for that, if anything, for money, to save money. I don't think it's going to happen this session. I think it's going to happen the session after this one, which is going to be historical, because if you see a prison in Texas closing, I think that would be really cool. The number of people on parole in terms of revocation has really drastically gone down. There's a lot less people being revoked who are on parole. And we're happy to see that, and I think that's going to continue to happen, to be the case. And the other opportunity that we're seeing is that a lot of policymakers are really upset at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for their failure to implement policies that they passed this last session. Why is that an opportunity for us? It's an opportunity for us because there's been a huge dialogue right now with key policymakers that are demanding efficiency and are demanding officials from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to think outside the box, so much that we're helping them formulate policies that will move them from Huntsville, at least the top heads, to Austin.
Oh yeah,
which
that's
is going
to
be huge.
That's what the women tried to do in the 20s.
So and so that's one of the things that is going to be a huge opportunity. And then and also linking their salaries, because like the executive director gets, you know, $18,000, you know, salary bonus, and you know, basically linking their salaries to their mission statement, which involves recidivism, which involves public safety,
that's awesome.
Which involves, and because there's been several escapes and there's been several things that deal with, you know, bringing guns and cell phones and other things, there's enough of a coalition of policymakers that are interested in holding them accountable, especially since they have such a huge budget. So I'm looking at taking advantage of that opportunity.
In terms of barriers, I mean, that's my focus, so it's not surprising, but I think that race, the incredible malleability and durability of white supremacy in American society, is our barrier. I mean, we're at a schizophrenic juncture in American race relations. On the one hand, there's this kind of culmination of the civil rights movement with the election of Barack Obama, which is no small matter. You know, my grandmother, who grew up in white segregated Mississippi, for her taking her walker in to vote for Obama was mind-blowing, completely unimaginable for the almost the entire arc of her life. But on the other hand, you know, now 55 years after Brown versus Board of Education, African-American men are more likely to go to prison than they are to graduate from college in the United States. And we've got these worsening rates of racial disparity. And I think, you know, it's the Republicans who figured out they could use the issue of law and order as a way to kind of talk about race and to mobilize anxious, angry white voters in the solid South and white, to a lesser extent, white working class voters in the North. That helped enable them to enact the counter-revolution in whose wake we're living in now, that endured from 1968 to 2008 and hopefully has now run its course. And the shift in focus from domestic law enforcement in terms of detention to immigrant detention, I think, is a kind of new wave of fear. It's a kind of new respectable way for talking about race. If you read the legislative statements in Arizona with this crazy package they just passed, you know, it's like this kind of total war. It really is what Public Enemy once called the fear of a black planet. But the opportunity is that demographics, as they know, and that's why they're fighting this fight, is not on their side. Texas is already not a majority white state, right? Or it will be soon.
It will be soon.
And America itself will not be a majority white country. And I'm living in Hawaii that has not been a majority white country ever. And I can tell you, it's better. So I think that demographics in the long term will help. In the short term, the fact that the bill has come due for 40 years of warring on crime and warring on drugs is a good thing. I actually perversely sort of think it's a good thing that the bill is really coming due in California, where the guards are paid so much that, you know, people are finally paying for the incarceration monster that they've built. And I still have some hope that the Obama administration can also be an opportunity. They have not yet, for the most part, played the politics of centrist compromise that the Clinton administration did so effectively by trying to protect their right flank by throwing criminal defendants to the wolves. Now, they've had a majority. They haven't yet had to operate with a congressional minority. We hope they don't. But, you know, the Obama administration has sounded more great society themes about crime than any administration since the Johnson administration. The fact that kind of somewhat conservatives like Jim Webb and Arlen Specter are pushing this National Criminal Justice Commission, which would launch the biggest investigation since 1967. All of that could turn out for good or ill, but my hope is that it can turn out for good.
So let's open it up for your questions. Sure, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. My name is Jim Sertival. I have a question. As reform is taking place, individual success stories out. Mm-hmm. When that happens, and I'm just wondering what you're all doing to prepare for that.
Great question.
Yeah, I mean, our reforms have not been, let's just open up the gate and everybody go and leave. So the thing with our reforms is that they've been really slow, like small, incremental. I mean, since, you know, 2003, like little by little. And so you haven't seen a lot of, you've actually in Texas have seen a lot of good stories on reentry, a lot of good stories on treatment. And we've done a lot of probation directors have come forth in terms of we're reducing the number of people we're revoking. So I think that we're doing okay in terms of that kind of stuff in Texas. And we compile stories. I mean, we respond to every letter that we get from prison. And people who we've written back to write us back and say we were able to find a job or we were able to get housing, and we have a list of people that reporters can call for that nice story. But I think that what you're talking about is in other states more when there's a backlash.
Well, and I think there has been a backlash in other states because they're a little bit farther along, right, than what Texas is. They're actually closing down prisons in states like New York and Michigan. And so the backlash is resistance to that from people who live in the towns where the prisons are because they're fearful of losing jobs and there needs to be economic programs in those towns to address those concerns. There in some of the newspaper coverage where there has been a backlash, take Michigan, for example. There was a New York Times cover story, a front page story in early March talking about early release in Michigan and how the headline was horrible. I can't restate it verbatim. But they focused on one incident of a sex offender who had re-offended. I don't even think he committed a new offense. I think he technically revoked.
Attempt, right? Wasn't it just an attempt?
I'm not sure the details, but I don't even think it was a new crime that he committed. And yet, so the narrative in that story was, you know, Michigan had done these early release policies, and they zeroed in on one guy of the hundreds of guys who had benefited from these early release programs that Michigan had been implementing since the early 2000s, and that was what they focused on. And that's what we're seeing a lot of, that the coverage of the story that continues to evolve is, you know, a few statistics get mentioned, and then they talk to a legislator who doesn't use any sort of evidence-based practices and sort of relies on anecdote and relies on people's fear on crime and sort of to sort of undermine and counter-cut some of the progressive policy reforms that have been taking place in the country. And there have been a lot of advocacy organizations who focus on reentry who are trying to counterbalance that story. And so in Michigan, when this story came out, there is a reentry organization, I would say a counterpart to what the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition is in Texas, who works at the forefront to counteract those types of that type of framing. And so it's incumbent upon advocates, people who continue to be concerned about these issues, to continue to write the narrative and to own the conversation as these policies get adopted.
And to use them for good. I mean, we there was a man who came out of prison who never received alcohol treatment, who killed somebody in DWI. And that just happened, you know, recently. And the Dallas Morning News had this story, but they knew that basically the story flipped in terms of we should never cut funding programs because he needed a treatment. Even Mad said they needed treatment. If you know, if we were to give them treatment, then they wouldn't have killed somebody. So there's opportunities to those ugly stories.
I'm somehow missing from this conversation a systems approach to thinking about the problem, and I would have liked to have heard more in that regard. Let me give you an example. In a systems approach, you consider what are the causes of crime, so you can think about mental illness and societal factors, passion. You can think about causes of incarceration, crime, drugs, and then you could say prejudice would be a subset of a cause of incarceration, which is what you were implying. You could talk about treatment of criminals, and then you can talk about training, work, solitary confinement, probation. These are all aspects of it. You can talk about outcomes, and that's recidivism, reintegration in the society, efforts to reintegration, and what cost savings are. And you could talk about the various sorts of interventions, downsizing being one, more prisons being one, and a stronger effort at rehabilitation being one. Why I say I am missing this and why I think it's important to discuss issues like this in a more systems framework is because when you make recommendations, then people can understand what the rationale is. I'm missing an understanding of what, from the whole discussion so far, what reform really means. The only thing I've gotten so far is reform means reducing the number of people in prison. Well, if it were the case that there was actually an increase in the number of crimes, reducing the number of people in prison wouldn't be a good systems solution. So, well, it may not be, let's say. It may be a good systems solution, but then if you have an increase in the number of crimes, you'd have to have some alternative way of handling it other than putting people in prisons. And so I'm looking for a more contextual understanding of what's going on so that I understand why you make the recommendations that you do.
I mean, I think it's right that we need to pay attention to the whole system. And I think on the ground, maybe not in the conversation, but on the ground, I think a lot of organizations are definitely doing that. I mean, the evidence is pretty clear that that the incarceration system that we've built is, not only is it hugely expensive and hugely racially divisive, but it's also not paying much in terms of dividends in public safety. I mean, there is some incapacitation benefit in terms of preventing crime, but, you know, Canada had crime drop in the 1990s, similar to crime drops in the U.S., and they didn't do anything like the incarceration boom. New York has had its own incarceration boom, but it hasn't been anything like California or Texas's, and its crime rate has dropped much more steeply. So there are a lot of arguments we can make, cost arguments, public safety arguments, about why every step of the way from better indigent defense, pressure on racial profiling, decriminalization of narcotics offenses, which are responsible for most prison entries every year, and better reentry to make that whole system better. And if you can shift the ground of the conversation from fear to evidence, then you can win on the evidence is on our side and all of that. Now, you know, as we know from the Glenn Beck program and so on, just because the evidence on your side doesn't mean that you will dominate the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, we actually decreased the crime rate in Texas by 3%. And everything that you just said is exactly what our policy primers look like in order for things to get the attention of practitioners, of policymakers, of which is so nice that I'm actually going to be able to, that I'm here because, you know, for once you get to actually talk about, you know, the challenges and the struggles that you have, such as not being able to deal with, you know, talk about race all the time. So, yes, we use all of that. And evidence-based practices and so.
I think what you guys are doing is terrific. Thank you. I think it's a shame we're not a little closer to the black church or an audience, so we could be applauding you and amening you a lot of the time for the stuff you said. Stephen Colbert calls his audience heroes, and you guys are absolutely heroes. Huh? My name is Harry Levine, and I'm part of a small but I think growing number of people who think that the future of Jim Crow and racist criminal justice is actually in petty offenses, is in misdemeanors, is in jails. And that's the thing that's growing, and that's the feeder to the prison systems. It's the what I have tended to call nowadays the Head Start for prison program. I've been focusing on the largest single misdemeanor offense in New York City, which is the possession of marijuana. It's also the single largest non-automotive offense in many other places in America, including, I think, maybe Texas. Mm-hmm. And I actually brought some marijuana arrest data from Texas, if anybody would like it. And I have arrest data from 44 counties in the United States showing the massive racial disproportion. Blacks are getting arrested at 3, 5, 7, 10 or times the rate of whites everywhere in America. What I want to ask you to talk about, and what I really want to do is lock you up and pick your brains for an hour, afterwards. I want to get information about how to get information about the Texas criminal justice system, in particular about policing and arrests and so on. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about my obsession, if you think it's am right, that policing and to some extent the prosecutors constitute a major enemy of reform. They, in many places, constitute the major obstacle for reform. They mobilize right-wing constituencies, at least they do in some places. Mm-hmm. They have enormous lobbying power. The budget of the New York Police Department is $4 billion. Robert, you said that the $4 billion of the New York Police Department, New York City Police Department, the lion's share of criminal justice money is not going to prisons, but is going to a variety of things, including the police department. And so I wanted to talk about what you see happening now in Texas with regard, you know, how does the low-level policing work? Cops are assigned to black and Latino neighborhoods everywhere, but that becomes the funnel to the criminal justice system. So could you just talk a little bit about that piece of the story?
Well, actually, the Texas Sheriff's Association was instrumental in helping advocates with the cite and release, which basically, especially for marijuana, and that was like, the actual sheriffs coming up and saying, look, you need to pass the cite and release because we cannot deal with our overcrowded jails. So that is a huge, that there's definitely opportunities there in terms of misdemeanors. And what we've been wanting to do is, change the classification to minimize to remove the jail time for misdemeanors, basically. And I think there's going to be a lot of momentum for that. The Texas Commission Jail Standards and our organization is doing a joint report on ways that counties can reduce the jail overcrowding. And in the recommendations, we list every single strategy of diversion you can think of. And so there's definitely, potential for
that.
What
does the police say about that?
The police don't really say anything. We got them really busy last session. Fighting a bill that would create a repository of racial profiling data into a state agency. We were the repository since 2001 of the racial profiling data after the law passed in 2001 to address the very same issue you're talking about. And finally, we got an agency to be that repository of racial profiling data. Our biggest challenge, we do have one DA. His name is John Bradley. He's from Williamson County. He sits in every single committee appointed by the governor. And he would be, the person that, calls treatment. He called one of the bills Drug Treatment Protection Act when we were talking about, treatment versus prison. So he's this kind of guy that, basically goes after anything that is human, anything good. But then the other DAs have, pretty much died down. They settled down. We try to work with as many of them as we possibly can. But you're right, that is a big challenge.
I think the issue in terms of sort of political strategy with district attorneys and sheriffs, for that matter, is that in probably every state, but particularly in Texas, they represent constituencies, right? District attorneys and sheriffs are elected countywide. So when progressive legislation is introduced or trying to counteract bad bills that get introduced in the Texas legislature, when a DA gets up and talks, can say stuff that they just pull out of thin air, no evidence-based practices, no police data representing, how folks enter into the system and are trapped up with petty offenses and what that how that contributes to the really large prison system in the state. It means something to those committee members because that John Bradley from Williamson County or, Sheriff Adrian Garcia from Harris County, where Houston is, they represent a base of voters. And so, that's sort of the struggle, especially when you're working on the ground and you're working on progressive reform or reform period. That's sort of the struggle that advocates have to deal with.
I started this work really interested primarily in prisons, post-felony conviction institutions, but I too have come to think that we have to pay a lot of attention to that front end, policing, indigent defense, I think, is an area where there could be kind of political coalitions put together. That can actually, over the long term, be a money saving, can save money, having a genuinely adversarial criminal justice system by having, protecting innocent people from going to prison, but many more people, having them have shorter sentences by having adequate representation that makes the proper motions on behalf of their client. And we have seen this massive shift from judicial to prosecutorial discretion that the left agreed to because they didn't like the racial bias and the arbitrariness of judicial discretion. The right didn't like because they hated those same judges who forced them to integrate their schools. But what's happened, I don't really know whether district attorneys are more racist or worse than judges. I think they probably are. But what that has really meant, shifting the discretion to prosecutors, is that it has just given them an enormous arsenal to use in their plea bargaining negotiations, in which almost all cases are settled against indigent defenses who are very poorly represented, especially poorly represented in Texas, and because they are making all the calling all the shots in terms of what's going to be filed, what they can be threatened with, they can use all, have all these mandatory minimums threats at their disposal. People are really having to plea out to much longer sentences than they would, and that helps bloat the system. So I agree there has to be a lot of attention on that front end.
Okay, we have time for just one more question. Lisa, you want to?
Yes. My question has to deal with the intersect between immigration and criminal justice, and you touched upon it a little bit. And as we see a decline in the prison population, we see an increase in the detention population, as you mentioned. So my question is, what role or responsibility do you think that advocates in the criminal justice reform movement have to either educate or impact or begin a movement, if none exists, in the immigration context to educate them on the perils of the trend or at least offer alternative solutions to the issue of undocumented immigrants in this country?
I would say that there are efforts to do that, right? I mean, so working on the Huddle campaign, you know, there was a strategic effort to intersect folks working at the front end of immigration reform in Texas with folks working on criminal justice reform in Texas. So, and while, you know, there is certain depopulation going on in the criminal justice system, a lot of the increase in immigration is not happening at the state level. Obviously, it's happening at the federal level because those are federal issues. And while states decreased their state populations, you know, 26 states decreased their state populations in 2009, the federal system actually grew by almost 7,000 beds. So keeping all that in mind, it continues to be important for the two advocacy efforts, which I don't think are strongly linked, although I think there are efforts to sort of connect the dots and sort of maintain linkages, but to keep those folks talking and address sort of what issues are on the table and what issues might be on the horizon.
I agree it's important for, you know, those experienced with much longer-term mass incarceration in the conventional criminal justice system to try to lend assistance and to make linkages to people who are working against this relatively new hyperinflation of the immigrant detention apparatus. But it can go the other way around, too. I mean, as we saw with the mobilizations of school kids and in L.A. and across the country, I mean, those were some of the immigrant marches in the last couple of years have been some of the biggest mass mobilizations in American history. I mean, city after city had the biggest march that had ever taken place in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the nuclear freeze movement, all of those kind of big mobilizations, none of them in many cities matched the size of those immigration marches. Now, so far, that seems to mainly have propelled a kind of right-wing backlash in terms of actual policy, but there is real potential for mobilization on an epic transformative scale if we can figure out how to kind of like mobilize and organize and institutionalize and harness that electricity and put it to good use.
I think we need to get the African American community and the Latino community in one, you know, in like in the same kind of, this is the experience that our community has had in terms of being African American and being in prison, and this is the experience that immigrants have had in terms of, you know, what's going on, because I think there's a lot of potential there. The problem that I see is the language barrier, and also the you know, the some of the sentiment that, well, you know, you're here, you're undocumented, you're illegal, you're breaking the law, and you're taking away my job. Mm. And grassroots leadership has a woman by the name of Tarsha Jackson, who's amazing, and she's been doing in Harris County, who's been trying to get that dialogue between Latinos and African Americans so that we can see those commonalities. But we are long, I mean, we need a lot of work on that, and we're not anywhere near where we need to be. I mean, I care about immigration because of my background, but if I had been born here, I probably wouldn't be as, like, if I had been born here, I probably wouldn't be as passionate at trying to kill like anti-immigration bills and things like that. So, yeah, we still have a long way to go in terms of that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, with that, I would like to have all of us thank our panelists and thank Robert for this amazing book. Great book. Buy it if you haven't. And thank you very much.